Daniel Patrick Moynihan famously wrote, "You're entitled to your own opinion, you're not entitled to your own facts." But what if facts, in the form of scientific findings, get in the way of politics? For many years now, scientific researchers have found themselves pressured to alter results to fit a particular political agenda. If they couldn't or wouldn't alter results, they were simply silenced. Nowhere has that been more common than in environmental issues. A new report defending the scientific integrity of conservation policy processes has just been published in the journal Conservation Biology. One of the report's authors is Daniel Rolfe, who joins us today. He teaches in the Lewis and Clark Law School's Environmental and Natural Resources Program and is also co-founder of the Earthrise Law Center. Good morning, Daniel. Thank you for being with us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So in your report, it uses the term scientific integrity. Can you define that for us?
Sure. We look at scientific integrity as the ability to perform, use, communicate, and publish science free from censorship or political interference.
And that is kind of one of the core issues that you're looking at in this report. That is really what you want to achieve with the processes that you outline.
Yes, certainly for making important public policy decisions in a lot of areas, but particularly in regulating and protecting our environment, quality science and accurate information is absolutely crucial. And of course, a lot of decisions that affect the environment have economic and political implications as well. So we looked at instances in the United States, Canada, and Australia where politicians, in order to make decisions come out a certain way, often turned to silencing scientists or manipulating facts to try to get to answers that they wanted to hear rather than answers that might be informed by better science.
So I want to talk about Canada and Australia a little bit later, but did interference in scientific studies in the United States, the actual pressuring of government scientists, really start with the administration of George W. Bush, or is there a much longer bipartisan history of that?
Well, unfortunately, it's always tempting if you don't get the answer you want to simply fudge the facts to help get to that answer. And so that temptation has always been around. But I do think we see that sort of practice become more prevalent in particular political administrations. And I think one of the things that we do identify in our article is real pressure under the George W. Bush administration on a variety of scientists related to decisions about the environment.
And so when we look at the integrity of scientific findings, are you also finding that the general public is still sort of skeptical about scientific findings? I think one of the popular lines of reasoning you hear from people is that, well, you know, the public has consumed all these scientific theories over the years, especially regarding their own health. You know, at one time butter was bad and margarine was good, and now margarine is bad and butter is maybe better and that sort of thing. Do you finding that the public really is kind of not really caring about this issue?
Well, actually, I think in our view, generally, the public really does care about science, particularly when it comes to the environment and public health. People want to breathe clean air and people want to drink clean water. So I think the public at large generally does value decisions made on good science about the environment. Unfortunately, one of the techniques that sometimes politicians can resort to, and I think we're seeing this being honed to a high art, especially in the, under the Environmental Protection Agency of the current administration, is kind of stoking some degree of public confusion about science. So the current administrator of the EPA Scott Pruitt, for example, is kind of a master of that, portraying so-called debates about climate change and so-called uncertainty about climate change science, when in fact the overwhelming scientific consensus is that climate change is happening and it's primarily caused by humans. But by playing up, especially some people's lack of clarity about what uncertainty in science really means, politicians like Mr. Pruitt are really able to exploit the science in the sense of creating far more quote-unquote debate or uncertainty when actually relatively little exists in some areas in the actual science.
So Scott Pruitt has actually proposed the EPA-sponsored debates about climate change science. Is that correct?
Yes, he's proposed sort of a red team, blue team, you know, almost nakedly political kind of debate about the science of climate change. And that's a wonderful example of exploiting, you know, the public's perhaps confusion about what uncertainty really means in science. And for climate change, there are a lot of things that scientists are not completely certain about around the margins of climate change, like exactly how quickly it's proceeding and exactly what storms may be caused or magnified by climate change. But there is essentially no credible scientific debate on the existence of climate change as a phenomenon caused by humans, whereas Mr. Pruitt is trying to use the scientific principle of uncertainty really toward political ends to basically reduce regulations on greenhouse gas emissions.
Our guest on the Jefferson Exchange this morning is Dan Rolfe. He teaches in the Lewis and Clark Law School's Environmental and Natural Resources Program and is also co-author of a new report, Defending Scientific Integrity. You can join the exchange discussion this morning by phone at 800-838-3760 or send your emails during the live broadcast to jx@jeffnet.org. Daniel, what are some of the tactics, the other tactics that politicians are using to short-circuit the free flow of scientific information in the policymaking process?
Well, we see some classics again going on in the United States right now. Things like silencing or editing scientists, eliminating scientific information from agency websites, or depriving the public of access to certain scientific information, reducing the input from outside experts and peer review, peer-reviewed science in agency decision-making. Again, for example, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has essentially terminated the participation of many outside scientists on EPA advisory boards, and will likely handpick other experts that tend to agree with more of a deregulatory agenda that the current administration is pursuing. I think less attention to policies that ensure scientific integrity, more intimidation of scientists within agencies who don't adjust their findings to go along with predetermined decisions about protecting and managing the environment. Those are sort of classic kinds of scientific manipulations that we've seen in the past, and unfortunately we're seeing again.
So you're focusing not only on protecting the work of government scientists, and if you're a scientist working for a government agency, there's a pretty clear situation there. If you're being pressured, it's, you know, going to come at the expense of your job, perhaps. But you also call out politicians for ignoring the work of non-governmental scientists. And, you know, can you describe the process by which non-governmental scientists are providing data into the decision-making process and how they are being manipulated?
Well, for example, we call for increased input from non-governmental scientists into decisions by government agencies to help ensure better scientific decisions. We cite an example of decisions to list species as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a policy calling for input from expert scientists outside the agency on decisions to list a species as threatened or endangered. The agency solicits the views of outside scientists. Unfortunately, however, when the agency decides not to list a species as threatened or endangered, the agency's policy does not call for any input from outside scientists on decisions not to protect a species. And examining many listing decisions, some of the most controversial listing decisions, including a decision not to list wolverines we cite in our paper, are very controversial. And unfortunately, those decisions, because we believe the flawed agency policy doesn't seek adequate input, those agency decisions do not call for any input from outside scientists.
So it's not so much that the outside scientists are seeing overt political pressure for their own findings. It's just that they're not being invited into the discussion in a lot of cases.
That's correct. It's much more difficult for politicians to exert influence on scientists outside agencies, although that is done sometimes by the government through its funding decisions and deciding whether or not to award grants to outside scientists, for example. But it is much more difficult to exert political pressure on outside scientists, and so we see independent experts and processes like peer review is potentially very valuable in providing unbiased outside quality science into government decision making.
So another issue that your report calls out is outbound communication, which I assume means the ability of scientists who are employed by governmental agencies to take their findings directly to the public. Are you seeing instances where scientists are simply being gagged?
Yeah, I mean, we recount a number of those instances in the United States as well as Canada and Australia, generally during more conservative political administrations when policies tend to favor economics rather than environmental protection. Unfortunately, oftentimes those drives come with efforts to silence scientists. And so scientific information will be eliminated from agency websites, or it will be withheld from the public, and scientists oftentimes are gagged. They're not allowed to speak to the public. Oftentimes they're not allowed to speak at conferences, or they must seek pre-approval for even publications they may wish to publish. And, you know, famously, James Hansen at NASA, for example, was babysat essentially for a period of time to try to ensure that he wasn't talking too much about climate change. And in the current administration in the United States, we've seen agencies like the Department of Agriculture basically instructing employees not to even talk about climate change, but instead to use euphemisms like weather extremes, or, you know, not talking about reducing greenhouse gases, but talking about improving organic matter in soil, things like that. It's really just removing information and trying to keep information from the public that could cause people to be concerned about the environment and even their own well-being.
Our guest on the Jefferson Exchange this morning is Daniel Rolfe. He teaches in the Lewis and Clark Law School Environmental and Natural Resources Program. You can join our conversation at 800-838-3760 or shoot us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. Anna Eugene is joining us with a question. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. So when are you going to point out that the only political party in the United States that is anti-science is the Republican Party? The Democratic Party does not quash scientific results. You keep saying politicians. Well, you should be saying Republican politicians. Thank you.
Okay, Dan, reply to that.
Well, I think in our paper we do particularly identify periods of time in the United States, Australia, and Canada where science has increasingly or has come under more extensive pressure from the government and from politicians. However, if I could speak from personal experience, I work with our environmental law clinic here at Lewis and Clark, and I've been involved in efforts to challenge decisions by federal agencies on behalf of environmental plaintiffs as part of our clinic's legal representation, and I can tell a caller from personal experience that unfortunately, manipulating or silencing science is a bipartisan practice, and we do believe, my co-authors and I do believe, that the incidence of that sort of pressure on science does go up generally under Republican administrations in the United States or more conservative administrations in Canada and Australia, but unfortunately it is kind of an equal opportunity phenomenon that occurs even when Democrats in the United States are in power at the executive level.
Well, Daniel, just like the United States, Canada and Australia have both oscillated between liberal regimes and very conservative regimes in the last, say, 10 or 20 years. What kind of lessons have you taken now from Canada and Australia?
Well, I think Canada would offer political lessons. I mean, we've seen them in our country as well. The current Canadian administration under Trudeau campaigned in part by promising to look towards facts and to protect science and to protect the environment. And I think people found that approach to be somewhat kind of fresh air and were attracted in part to candidate Trudeau because of those promises. And so, you know, from our view, it is important for leaders to support scientific integrity. And often the public, we believe, will respond to that because, you know, as I indicated before, people generally want to breathe clean air, drink clean water, and see science is a crucial part of deciding how to manage and protect the environment. And so we think that politicians who do espouse support for science and campaign on that issue can use that toward political success and therefore build public pressure that promotes scientific integrity and values scientific integrity.
So what protections, specific protections for scientists are you proposing in your report?
We identify a number of things that could better protect science in the process of managing and protecting the environment. Things like strengthening and actually implementing scientific integrity policies in government agencies. So, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Department of Interior, under President Obama, developed science integrity policies which require agency scientists to use good science, but also require even agency political appointees not to put pressure on scientists. And we'll see what happens to those policies under the current administration in the United States, but strengthening and actually implementing those policies we see as an important step. Things like strengthening collective bargaining among scientists who work for the government, giving them better job protections, giving them better legal whistleblower protections, can protect scientists from being put in a position of saying, we want you to change the facts or your job is on the line. Nobody should be put in that sort of position. We advocate for more input from a variety of scientists outside the government when government agencies make decisions about the environment, and that government agencies should at least have to respond to that sort of input. So if they get independent scientific input from outside the government before an agency makes decisions, it should a government agency should at least explain what its views are on the scientific input it's received. And then finally, we call for strengthening social support and support of political leadership among the agencies for scientific integrity, and really underlining that as an important tool of government.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel Rolfe, for joining us today. Daniel Rolfe is in the Lewis and Clark Law School's Environmental and Natural Resources Program, and his new report is Defending the Scientific Integrity of Conservation Policy Processes. Thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks very much for the invitation.